You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 14th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mark Joseph Stern, staff writer at Slate.com, on the major rulings we are anticipating tomorrow from the Supreme Court. Also on the program, next January 6th hearing has been pushed to Thursday. Yesterday's hearing focused on Trump's mens rea and Bill Barr's ass cover-up. Yeah.
Of the best mens rea.
I'm a real mens rea. Senate continues to negotiate on, if you can believe it, pay-fors. For the anemic gun bill. Ohio reduces training requirement of armed teachers in the classroom from 700 hours to 24 hours.
Free market.
House passes the Ocean Shipping Reform Act, and it's primary day in Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, South Carolina. Speaking of primaries, so-called centrist Dem Kurt Schrader, who lost his primary despite being supported by President Biden, has torched Democrats in every way possible since his loss. Huh.
Vote blue no matter who.
Fed rumored planning to raise interest rates this week by 0.75, three quarters of a point, in order to crush worker gains. Oh, and supposedly to deal with inflation. Ukraine on the verge of losing a key city in Donbass. And Starbucks. 150 now Starbucks out of, 15,000. But all but 20 who have voted on a union have unionized. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is, well, I'll let Emma Vigeland tell you what today is.
It is Newsday Tuesday.
Yeah, except for we're having
Mark Joseph Stern. This is going to probably dominate the news. This is a preemptive, getting ahead of the Supreme Court rulings that are happening tomorrow.
I suspect that the reason why the House moved their hearing till tomorrow, to Thursday, was to avoid the announcements from the Supreme Court. Now, here's an idea. If you were, let's say, involved in the leadership of one of the branches, there's only two houses in there's three branches of our government. There's only two houses, I guess.
Chambers,
if you will, in our legislative body, and you were overseeing these hearings, which are both, I think, vitally important to maintaining the integrity of our democracy, but also important, at least, I wouldn't have put as much stock as the Democrats have, but it's all that they have at this point, electoral chances in November, you might anticipate, that the Supreme Court is going to make announcements on at least three monumental cases sometime in the middle of June. And you might not want to have your hearings during that time, if the idea was we want publicity for these hearings.
like the people on ESPN that schedule the NBA finals and the NHL finals, like ABC, ESPN working together to make sure they're not on the same day, have better coordination than the Democratic Party. But, you know, they might have not been able to go through their Memorial Day vacation in the same sequencing. So we know what the priorities are.
All right. With that said, let's talk about what happened yesterday. They played. Now, I feel like we saw at least a clip of Barr's testimony. Maybe it was on the first day of the hearings. There's a lot of people who are angry at Bill Barr because there's such a quality of this. And we're seeing this with actually a lot of the Republicans who have testified of like I use this example, less because they were Nazis, but more because they were German soldiers after losing World War II. You know, they would burn their uniforms so that they could not, they're basically escaping responsibility for what they did. There's a little bit of that going on here with Bill Barr, just a little bit. But I also think there's something even more nefarious going on with this Bill Barr testimony.
Besides the book deal.
Besides the book deal, besides all of it. But here is his testimony. And remember, there is talk of hoping that the Department of Justice is going to charge Donald Trump. What he could be charged with, well, let's talk about it after this.
I had a later meeting scheduled at the White House at 3 o'clock with Meadows. This was previously scheduled, so I knew this was going to come up, and I went over there, and I told my secretary that I thought I would probably be fired and told not to go home. I mean, not to go back to my office, so I said, you might have to pack up for me. And so when I got over there, I met with the chief of staff. He said the president was angry. He didn't really get into the issue of the fraud. And then I went up to Pat Cipollone's office and we were talking with each other. And word came down that he wanted us both to go to the Oval. And the president was as mad as I've ever seen him. And he was trying to control himself. And the president said, well, this is, you know, killing me. You didn't have to say this. You must have said this because you hate Trump. You hate Trump. And then he raised the big vote dump, as he called it, in Detroit. And that, you know, he said people saw boxes coming into the counting station at all hours of the morning and so forth. And I explained to him that I at that point, I knew the exact number of precincts in Detroit. I think it was 630 something. I said, Mr. President, there are 630 precincts in Detroit. And unlike elsewhere in the state, they centralized the counting process. So they're not counted in each precinct. They're moved to counting stations. And so the normal process would involve boxes coming in at all different hours. So there's nothing. And I said, did anyone point out to you? Did all the people complaining about it point out to you? You actually did better in Detroit than you did last time. I mean, there's no indication of fraud in Detroit. And I told him that the stuff that his people were shoveling out to the public was bullshit. I mean, that the claims of fraud were bullshit. And you know, he was indignant about that.
Now, he goes on to say, do we have the part to say where he's not in reality?
Yeah, no, there's more to this.
There's more to this. Because and just as we get that clip, this is Bill Barr. You know, now, remember that Bill Barr did not ultimately resign for weeks after this.
And in the lead up to the election, he was making claims, seemingly at the behest of Trump and the media, that there was going to be a fraud via the mail-in ballots all the time, laying the groundwork for this kind of stuff.
Setting the table constantly setting the table for the idea that fraud was going to take place. But this is the important part, and I think this is the more nefarious part. Obviously, Bill Barr is up here. He's trying to pretend like, well, I was the only reasonable person in the room, despite the fact that, you know, we had set it up so much that all we needed was anything that was even remotely smelling of this. Now, of course, we should also say the idea that it didn't seem odd to him that Trump was referring to himself in the third person is also, I think, worth noting.
Yeah.
Now, as we all know in this office, you don't mess with Cedar.
Right.
Yeah, you can get used to that, actually.
You don't mess with Cedar.
We have to say, we love Cedar.
Right.
We love Cedar, not we hate Cedar.
I say we love Cedar, too. Let's go.
Loyalty.
But here's the point where I think Bill Barr is actually both covering his ass and Donald Trump's.
He went off on a monologue saying that there was now definitive evidence involving fraud through the Dominion machines. And I was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact he's become detached from reality if he really believes this stuff. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would, you know, tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
So this point where he says he was divorced from reality, to the extent that there's any legal jeopardy for Donald Trump in terms of attempting the statutes about defrauding the United States government or an agency of the United States government, it is his awareness that he was lying or attempting to defraud the government. And when Bill Barr floats the idea that he was detached from reality, it suggests that he could not have known, if he's detached from reality, that in fact he lost. And therefore, pursuit of the what was a big lie, it doesn't become a big lie in terms of a legal perspective. It becomes a big delusion.
Why would he want to protect Trump? He's already capitalizing on divorcing himself from that, wrote a big book, decided to go off in the testimony. And also, this kind of implicates him, because if Trump was detached from reality and he had those weeks afterwards where he was still in the administration, why did he not seek the 25th Amendment?
He just they were talking about it. They found I think there's been testimony already that the 25th Amendment, they figured that it wouldn't work. But Bill Barr has just said, I gave him the facts. He didn't want to hear them because he's detached from reality. Why would Bill Barr want to avoid Donald Trump being prosecuted? Because if Donald Trump is prosecuted and actually thinks he's in any type of legal jeopardy, he's going to take anyone around him and find every single thing he has about them and throw it at the DOJ as a way of saving his own skin. So I imagine Bill Barr knows that there were things that went on in that White House that would not be healthy for him as well as Donald Trump. And so Bill Barr gets out there. He has his cake. I was the reasonable one. I was on team reasonable in the White House as opposed to, you know, Rudy Giuliani,
yeah,
stuck in a bottle. And but at the same time, I'm also protecting Donald Trump by floating his defense. And his defense is, no, it was not in touch with reality.
Yeah, I don't think that's implausible. I was just working it out.
Bill Barr never says a word publicly that doesn't suit him. He is a lawyer through and through in that respect. And, I mean, this is a guy, let's remember, here's a guy on one hand saying he was completely detached from reality. Here's what he said with what guy from NBC?
Lester
Savannah
Holt.
Guthrie. Oh, this was with Savannah Guthrie.
Oh, it was?
This Today's Show interview.
Savannah Guthrie. Here it is.
Finally, got you say in your book, it's time for the party to move on from Trump. Liz Cheney has said he is not fit to serve and should not be ever near the Oval Office again. Do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly have made it clear I don't think he should be our nominee, and I'm going to, you know, support somebody else for the nominee.
But if he is the nominee and you have your choices, Donald Trump or whoever's running on the Democratic side, would you vote for him?
Because I believe that the greatest threat to the country is the progressive agenda being pushed by the Democratic Party. It's inconceivable to me that I wouldn't vote for the Republican nominee.
So even if he lied about the election and threatened democracy, as you write in your book.
Well, it's better
than a Democrat.
It's hard to project what the facts are going to turn out to be three years hence. But as of now, it's hard for me to conceive that I wouldn't vote for the Republican nominee.
Yeah.
But that must have been before all this evidence was presented and before we had a full understanding of the scope of how, you know, Trump was coordinating with these shady groups and what the insurrection actually meant.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the date of that, and that was actually after all that.
What?
I know. Shocking. Shocking. Bill Barr, not your friend. Just a reminder. Also, you know, for that matter, Liz Cheney, not your friend. Liz Cheney, not your friend. You can be excited all you want at her performance in this committee hearing, but do not kid yourself about Liz Cheney. If you want to know what she's willing to do in terms of what she perceives as her own political value to herself, remember, this is a woman who came out against gay marriage when her sister was hoping to marry her partner. She is willing to do anything if she perceives it in her political interest. And I know a lot of you say, well, she's been ostracized in the political in the Republican Party. She is, relatively speaking, probably, I don't know, what, 30 years younger or 40 years younger than the people who are now leading this country in the House and in the Senate and in the presidency. She just made a bet that she could not make it through. She could not out Marjorie Taylor Greene. And so she just chose a different lane. And this is the lane that she's taken. And it is for political expediency. Do not delude yourself.
Well, I mean, yeah, I saw that Robert Rice shop at.
Oh, my God.
Just, dude.
Comparing him to Paul Wellstone?
Liz Cheney for president.
Lunacy.
And I like Reich. That's I don't get it.
Well,
don't let this break your brain, basically.
We're gonna be talking to Mark Joseph Stern in a moment. Just a word from our sponsor today. Start Mail. Free email services like Gmail, Yahoo, and I don't know, is AOL still around? Some people I know.
Some people still.
Yeah, they're not free. You're the product. You pay with your privacy. You write something in there like, hey, you know, I'm thinking about getting a lawnmower, and then all of a sudden Gmail starts serving you up lawnmower ads. Not just in your email thing, across the web. Internet giants exploit your data. They sell it to the highest bidder. With Start Mail, you can feel safe again. Start Mail also keeps your email private. Every email can be encrypted, even if the recipient doesn't use encryption. And when you delete an email in Start Mail, it's gone forever. Switching to Start Mail is seamless. You can transfer all your current email data instead of starting from scratch. So you get all those, you have years and years of emails. You don't want to lose that person's email address. You can migrate it right over. It's super easy. Start Mail uses their own servers. It's backed by one of the most stringent privacy laws in the world. Start Mail, you get unlimited anonymous aliases. So when you're giving your email to a company but want to protect your identity, Start Mail can generate a shareable alias email that can be deleted anytime. That is a huge, there are basically three reasons. Well, maybe four, but one of them is somewhat idiosyncratic that I use Start Mail. And the idiosyncratic one is that I like to have a bunch of different email addresses because that's the way I organize things. Mm. But the value of Start Mail is, A, you're going to get less phishing because the Gmail emails and the Yahoos, you're going to get more phishing on that one. It is the encryption is important, but also the aliases are incredibly. How many times do you sign up for something? Like you got to go buy your daughter something at like Brandy Melville. But do I want to get Brandy Melville emails? And do I want them to have my data? And no, I don't. So I give them an alias that it's like a burner account that is built into your thing.
Right.
But for many people, it's the privacy. It is the lack of selling your data. It is the encryption. But for me, it's also that tremendous convenience. And it's also, frankly, it's more secure there's a couple of things that I will use my Star Mail for that I won't use the other ones for. Like, you know, if I got to do like my bank account or something like that, because it's just, it's not commonly used email like Gmail. You can start securing your email privacy with Start Mail today. Sign up today and you'll get 50% off your first year. Go to startmail.com/majority. That's Startmail with a T, S-T-A-R-T, startmail.com/majority for 50% off your first year. Startmail.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Mark Joseph Stern, staff writer at Slate. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Mark Joseph Stern. He is a staff writer at Slate.com. Mark, welcome. This is sort of like the, well, I don't know if it's the calm before the storm, but I mean, it's the, maybe it's like the storm before the, I don't know, the tsunami hits tomorrow. We're anticipating three major cases to drop, or three, four at least, maybe more, to drop tomorrow. I also want to look back on a case that was decided, a week or two ago, because the implications of that are pretty serious. But let me just ask a meta question. What do you make about them dropping all of these cases in one day, and then it feels like, you know, we're going to get out of Dodge?
So I guess I will just say this happens every year and we forget over the previous 11 months each time. And then every June we're like, oh my God, why is this happening? It's the same thing every single term. The justices have cushy summer jobs to get to. They have vacations. They have families. They have stuff to do in July. And no matter how backed up they seem in June, no matter how many opinions they have left in the middle of June, they always find a way to finish by the first week of July, if not earlier. So I was not surprised to see a massive dump of opinions. I think we'll continue to see these dumps over the coming opinion days. And that's just what happens. And I'd like to say it's a sign of a problem, but it's just the really weird and unpleasant way that the Supreme Court functions.
So how many days? So is we're anticipating some decisions to come down tomorrow. And then yes. Are there other days that we can anticipate? Or do you think like, I mean, look, Roe is going to be, has the potential, if it's anything like Alito's brief, to be, like an earthquake. And the other ones are also earthquakey. Were it not for Roe. But do you think they're, how conscious are they of like, we're going to do the most controversial ones later and then get at it? Like, is the last one we're going to hear Roe, and where could that could be as late as, you know, whatever, July 5th?
So I do think that they will probably release the decision overturning Roe on one of the last, if not the last, opinion days. My guess is that the last opinion day will be Friday, July 1st. I strongly suspect that they all have plans over July 4th weekend and don't want something as trivial as rewriting the Constitution to get in the way of that. We'll probably have four or five more opinion days through the rest of the term, possibly six. There are 24 cases to go.
Oh, wow.
And about five or six of those are obviously really major. And the court likes to stagger the release of its major decisions so that they don't release more than one blockbuster on a single day. So if you see the court release a big decision on a Thursday and then schedule another opinion day for the following day, that probably means that we're going to be blasted with horror 24 hours later. And then there's this thing that the court does where they don't actually tell us when the opinion days will be until the day before or 2 days before. So we actually can't know when those days will be beyond Wednesday. It could be Thursday, Friday. It could be random days next week, the week after. It is all a mystery until the court reveals it. So they are all working at the very last minute to try to wrap up these cases. And we know almost nothing until the opinions themselves finally drop.
Maybe they take a page out of the book of like bad PR from, you know, say sports leagues do this too. Like last year, the NFL did this with the investigation into Washington's sexual misconduct. They dumped it on the Friday before July 4th. And then you totally, the news cycle, the reporters are away. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they will do that. Or maybe it would have less of an impact if they just release them all on the same day this time around.
I've always been surprised that they don't do that. I would think that if they want to just kind of get it over with, they would dump them all on the same day. And then the news cycle would be sort of overwhelmed and it would all be a big mess for a few days and then pass. But instead, they like to draw it out. Maybe they enjoy the drama or the tension.
Yeah, but they need a PR consultant, but then that would get in the way of like their narcissism. So there's that.
Right. Yes. Definitely no real PR professionals working at that Supreme Court. I will say that this is an unusual term in that the biggest decision, which is, of course, Dobbs, the abortion case, the decision when it comes down is not going to be the end of anything. It's going to be the start of something. It's going to be the start of about two dozen states banning abortion and launching us into this brave new world of, you know, extremely draconian abortion bans that criminalize not just intentional termination of pregnancy, but also other pregnancy outcomes, including quite possibly miscarriages.
Yep.
And so we're going to see all of these states experimenting with new penal codes that have not existed in this country for more than 50 years, finding creative ways to punish doctors, pharmacists, patients, friends, families of patients. And I think that however hard the court tries to just drop the Dobbs opinion on a Friday and then hope it disappears, it's not going to happen because we're going to spend the rest of our lives dealing with the outcome of that case.
Yes. And I mean, and we could be 3 years away from a federal ban on abortion, frankly, for that matter. All right. And I would also imagine in terms of rolling these things out, there's some administrative challenges, right? I mean, you need to You could prep all these things and have them ready to go, but maybe you'd be worried about leaks. And just before we get to the substance of the cases, have you heard anything else about the leak, about the leak investigation? And, do you have, when you sit around talking to your, you know, legal peeps, your Supreme Court peeps, do you guys have theories as to where that leak came from?
So unfortunately, I do not have any special sources inside the court who know anything about the leak. I'm just going on what every other reporter who does have those sources has told us. But to your second question, I mean, the consensus among most court watchers, I would say, is that it was probably someone affiliated with a conservative justice who does not want Kavanaugh or Barrett to wobble and was trying to shore up their vote with a leak by making it maximally embarrassing and difficult for them to jump ship. And I mean, that theory is rooted partially in just human psychology, but also in history, because we know that so many times it has seemed like the court was on the brink of doing something really big, and then a justice jumped ship and flipped the outcome. It happened in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 92. It happened in the first Obamacare case in 2012. It happened in the census case. So I think that there may have been someone in the conservative chambers, maybe a clerk, maybe a staff assistant, who wanted to prevent that. Maybe they got permission from the justice, maybe not. I don't know. But that theory makes far more sense to me than any competing ideas.
And let me just say, there's only three options of justices, if they're trying to convince Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh, it's unlikely one of their clerks was the one who leaked it. And that leaves three others, Alito and Gorsuch and Thomas. And we know that in 2012, there was a similar leak leading up to that ACA case to, I think, the Wall Street Journal, where there were also leaks this time. And by leak, I mean just, you know, someone talking about internal deliberations who was close to the conservative justices. So if you're out there betting and somebody gives you odds on someone affiliated with Alito and Thomas, that's your best bet. Not that we are encouraging gambling.
But not that we'd ever find out. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever find out who the leaker is.
We shall see.
Yeah.
All right. With that said, let's talk about a case that that was decided a couple of weeks ago. Andrus versus Texas. This is astonishing. This is astonishing to me, this case, the way they ruled this. Explain the situation. It deals with the Sixth Amendment.
Yes. So the Sixth Amendment guarantees a right to effective assistance of counsel, meaning that if you get a lawyer who does an absolutely atrocious job, you can have your verdict, your conviction overturned and get a new trial. And this case involved a terrible lawyer who did an atrocious job. His client was on trial for two murders in Texas. It was a capital trial. And the whole deal at capital trials is that the defendant has to present what's called mitigating evidence to show that they don't deserve the death penalty. And if a single juror in Texas specifically decides that the mitigating evidence is strong, then that individual cannot be executed or subject to the death penalty. And this lawyer did not present any mitigating evidence for his client, Mr. Andrus, even though his client had been horrifically abused from an extremely young age, tormented and tortured by his mother's many boyfriends, exposed to horrific domestic abuse and drug use, placed in a notoriously cruel juvenile detention center where he was overdosed with psychotropic drugs to treat severe mental disorders that are exactly what led to him committing this crime. So, you know, this was so obviously ineffective assistance of counsel for the lawyer not even to say this, for to keep the jury in the dark, that in 2020, the Supreme Court issued a decision that said, as a matter of constitutional law, what this guy's lawyer did violated the Sixth Amendment. This is not effective assistance of counsel, and sent the case back down to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals to apply the Sixth Amendment correctly. And incredibly, the Texas court said, actually, we disagree with the Supreme Court. We think that the Supreme Court got it wrong. We don't believe that this was ineffective assistance of counsel, and we are not going to overturn this guy's conviction, which is just open and direct defiance of SCOTUS. And so Mr. Andrus appeals this decision back to the Supreme Court, and the court swats it away and refuses to consider it, and effectively allows a lower court to overrule it from below, which is just not how precedent or stare decisis works.
And so what are the implications, though, in terms of the way that it affects the law going forward?
I mean, what it means is that a conservative majority of this Supreme Court doesn't care about protecting the right to counsel and the right to effective assistance of counsel. And that's a huge problem, because so many cases involving the death penalty involve ineffective counsel. As a general rule, if you have a good lawyer, you will not be sentenced to death. Good lawyers can generally avoid a death sentence. It's only ineffective lawyers in all but the most extreme cases who can't figure out how to avoid it. And so all of these people on death row, they are trying to bring these claims to show that their lawyers, in some cases, literally fell asleep during the trial, failed to do any investigation to puncture the prosecution's evidence, didn't even cross-examine key witnesses, you know, that kind of thing. And over again, the Supreme Court has been shutting down those cases and using both procedural and substantive tools to do it. So just a few weeks ago, the court, the conservative supermajority, basically slammed the courthouse door shut on people who received ineffective assistance of counsel and were sentenced to death, even if they have compelling proof that they are literally actually innocent and that they could not have committed their crime because they have a watertight alibi. The Supreme Court 2 weeks ago said, we don't care. You do not get access to a court. You are going to be put to death without ever presenting your claim. And this latest decision follows on the heels of that and is very similar.
So the just be clear, there's two different cases that we're talking about that deal with the Sixth Amendment over the past month, essentially. One is the first one, not the Andrus case. The first one was ineffective counsel. Then they had ineffective counsel in arguing that they had ineffective counsel. And once you get one case removed from the first ineffective counsel, the Supreme Court says, okay, all bets are off. This right like expires on some level or something.
That's absolutely right. The court has put an expiration date on constitutional rights that it disfavors. And it has really just shut down what's called habeas review, which is what you get when you've already been convicted of a crime, but you have, say, new evidence or the law has changed. You have some reason to say that your conviction was unlawful and illegitimate. The court has basically quashed that and said that it's not available anymore because Anthony Kennedy is gone and things have changed around here.
Yeah, and this is less of a legal question and more of a political one, or maybe not, but it should go without saying, right, that the ineffective counsel cases are probably disproportionately in representation of poor individuals who have less access to good lawyers. I mean, almost near 100%, right?
Yes. Again, it's this problem of if they had good lawyers in the first place, they wouldn't be in this situation. The death rows of various states are filled with people who had bad public defenders who were representing 50 clients at the same time, who had 10 minutes to prepare for a capital trial. And the Supreme Court has basically blessed that system because I think, frankly, a conservative majority doesn't even believe that there is a right to effective assistance of counsel. But the court has realized that it can avoid backlash by not just saying, okay, well, there's no more right here. They just cut off all access to exercising that right. So lower courts can just deny Sixth Amendment claims and we won't do anything about it. Federal courts can slam their doors to new evidence and we won't do anything about it. You know, it's this concept of not overtly reversing precedent, but allowing it to die on the vine. And that is a political strategy as much as a legal one that this conservative majority has very much embraced.
I want to just focus on that dynamic for a moment, because, the mistake I think some people make about the Supreme Court is they will look at a case and they'll look at the specifics of that case and assume that the case begins and ends with that. But that's not the way it works with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is creating a structure and a superstructure for the rest of the courts in the country. And this instance, it's a state court, which is in some respects theoretically outside of its its branch of government slightly, you know, because this is a state court as opposed to the federal court system. Can we even imagine what the implications are of this? Sometimes it's very hard to, when they did Bush v. Gore, they said this case is it. This is a one-off. This has no bearing on future cases. We don't even want you to cite this case. And I don't know how many times that Bush v. Gore has been cited, but I know it's like at least dozens of times in federal cases since then. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But do we have a sense of like what message this sends to Supreme Court justices, state Supreme Court justices in South Carolina, Missouri, Alabama, or what it says to even to like circuit courts, like maybe in like the Fifth Circuit that deals with some of these, red states, conservative justices on there? Can we even like sort of, I don't know, project into the future what the implications of this are?
I mean, you took the words right out of my mouth with the Fifth Circuit. Obviously, what's going to happen is that conservative and partisan lower court judges are going to start ignoring decisions of the Supreme Court that they dislike and hope that they can get away with it. And I think you described it very well. Another way to think about it is that the Supreme Court sits at the head of a massive bureaucracy. We don't think of it that way because it's judicial, but it is just another government bureaucracy. And the lower courts, state Supreme Courts, federal appellate courts, they are sort of like middle managers, and they take their cues from the top. And they are really good at reading those cues, whether they are loud and blaring or subtle. And what the court is telling them now, all of these middle managers on the courts below, is, hey, you can pretty much guess which constitutional rights we don't like and which precedents we want to overturn. And if you just stop enforcing them, if you just start violating our precedents, we're not going to do anything about it. In fact, we might even give you a pat on the head. And so this goes way beyond the Sixth Amendment context. I mean, I think this case is tragic and horrific, but it's so much more than the right to counsel. This was the game that the Supreme Court played with abortion, and it's the reason why abortion is already illegal in two states, even though Roe is still on the books. Now they're playing it with the right to counsel. What will be next? And so it's a way for the court up at the top to kind of protect its reputation. This is an extreme example, but you know, there was this idea in Germany of working toward the Führer. The Führer didn't say exactly what he wanted, but his people knew the idea and worked toward it. That is what the Supreme Court is doing with lower courts. They're saying, work toward us. Figure out what we want and do it, and we will reward you when you do it correctly, or at the very least not punish you.
It reminds me of that the Wells Fargo scandal, where they had basically said, like, you're going to get bonuses if you sign our clients up for these other things.
Open more accounts
and whatnot, and just get it done. And then you had, you know, Wells Fargo underlings signing people up for these, you know, extra products that they didn't even know that they were signing up for. And that was just sort of, and then they're just like, we had no idea. We just created the circumstance. It's not too dissimilar from the torture regime, frankly, on some level, where the Rumsfeld basically said, we're unshackling you guys. You guys go at it, and we, you know, you'll be doing God's work. We're not going to give you the order to do that. And just you referenced abortion, just so that people know what you're talking about. That Texas case never was resolved. They just basically punted it. And by any stretch of any imagination, it was a de facto overturning of Roe v. Wade. I mean, by any measure whatsoever, it encumbered a woman's right to choose prior to whatever it was, 24 weeks of gestation. So let's move to that. As I mean, I think everyone knows now, hopefully, that's listening to the show. Otherwise, you know, I think it's time for me to retire. That over the next couple of weeks, it's very likely the Supreme Court is going to overturn Roe v. Wade. Do you think there's going to be any are we going to see essentially Alito's brief, and that's basically going to be it? There may be some like fudging around the edge, but at this point, like, what's your sense of that?
I think that we'll basically see the draft a little bit cleaned up and a little bit toned down in some sections, specifically the parts that just openly castigate previous justices for supporting the right to choose. I imagine that won't sit well with Brett Kavanaugh. You know, other than that, it's going to be all about toning it down rhetorically, about making it more aesthetically appealing. I don't think there's going to be any substantive changes to the draft. Because again, you know, Alito had those votes locked in February, and they must have known more or less what Alito was going to say. You know, the conservative legal movement has been writing a version of that draft for almost 50 years now. Nothing in it surprised me even a little bit. So I think that if Barrett and Kavanaugh have real qualms with it, they'll write some separate opinion trying to make themselves seem like the good guy. But I think we're going to get a decision that looks very, very similar, if not identical, to the draft we all saw in May.
All right. And I don't, you know, obviously not minimizing the implications of essentially allowing, you know, half the states in this country more to outlaw abortion. But it also, that brief also mentioned Griswold. It also mentioned the Texas case that where the Supreme Court said you cannot pass laws against sodomy. And he referenced, he analogized those decisions in many respects to Roe v. Wade, in that there were sort of rights in the Constitution that were sort of made up. That becomes, even if Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett or whomever write something like, I'm not on board with that, but that becomes part of the canon, doesn't it? And we're going to see maybe the Fifth Circuit cite that dicta, essentially, in the brief, in some case, maybe a year or 2 years from now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is dicta, which means it's not formally part of the holding, but it is another signal to lower courts about which direction SCOTUS is moving in, and a kind of encouragement, a kind of wink and a nod to those lower courts to start shifting in that direction. And, you know, the lower courts have all of these tools at their disposal to kind of force issues to the Supreme Court. And so all the Fifth Circuit has to do is uphold a sodomy ban or a same-sex marriage ban or a ban on IUDs or whatever. And that essentially forces the issue to SCOTUS. And so, you know, if those passages remain, and I do think that it could be one of the places where the rhetoric gets toned down a bit, but if those passages remain, you will absolutely start seeing litigation in the lower courts, specifically conservative and Republican courts, trying to roll back these other precedents, protecting rights to personal autonomy. Because Alito's line is, well, the idea of personal autonomy doesn't make any sense as a legal concept, because if it were true that you have a right to control your body, then you'd have a right to do drugs and engage in sex work. And that's obviously not true. So how could you possibly have a right to engage in sodomy?
And we should say there are, and this happens on the, you know, nominal left to some extent, not with the same, I think, efficiency that it happens on the right. But there are organizations dedicated out there to waiting for that dicta and saying, okay, let's go find a plaintiff here and let's push this case so that we can go to these places and do that. And that's what we're going to see. And I also have a prediction that if he doesn't mention Griswold in the final product, if we don't see Griswold, we don't see that Texas case, some court is going to cite the leaked brief and say this is what they were thinking on some level there anyways.
I mean, multiple Republican judges literally cited a tweet that Ron Klain retweeted from an MSNBC anchor as proof that the vaccine mandate was illegitimate. And so I don't think that what you're describing or predicting is at all unreasonable. I think it's probably a safe bet that that will indeed occur.
Let's talk about the next case, which I think is also, you know, really terrifying and part of a long-term sort of project to return us to the Lochner era. That is the EPA versus West Virginia, or West Virginia versus the EPA. And this is the doctrine at stake here is sort of a cousin to the, I guess, the Chevron doctrine on some level, and that is the major questions doctrine. And before we even get into that, this is also another example of a case that the Supreme Court does not need to even hear, right? Because my understanding is this is it's an Obama-era regulation that never went into effect. The Biden administration is going to propose a new rule, a different one. So there's no case here, really, right?
There is currently no EPA regulation limiting carbon at coal-fired power plants. And this case is explicitly about the legality of an EPA regulation limiting carbon at power plants. There is no controversy. There is no rule to strike down. There is nothing for the Supreme Court to actually do except to tell the Biden administration, don't even try regulating greenhouse gases, because if you do, we will step in immediately and shut you down. The immediate impact of this case will be nothing because, like you said, there is simply no regulation for the court to even invalidate.
And generally, it's been the case that the court says, like, well, since there's no controversy and since this will have only hypothetical implications going forward, we don't know what the Biden administration is going to propose. We wouldn't handle this case unless we basically want to say, hey, the whole way that you've been doing government for the past 90 years, yeah, that's changing now.
Yes. I mean, and that language comes from the Constitution, which says that the Supreme Court can only decide a case or controversy. And so the idea of resolving hypothetical future disputes is really anathema to judicial review. But, you know, the conservative justices don't care anymore.
Judicial pre-review. And yeah. Do you see that this is going to, I mean, frankly, what it seems to me that there's going to be a lot more cases in the coming year that are targeting preemptively regulations from the Biden administration.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you followed the social cost of carbon case, but this was a recent example of what you just described, Emma, where Biden convened this working group that was going to figure out basically the externalities of carbon. How much does it cost society and humans and the earth per ton of carbon? And eventually the results of that group were going to be factored into regulations. But this was just a bunch of eggheads working together on Zoom. And a Trump judge issued a nationwide injunction blocking the existence of that working group because he said that they would eventually produce a result that would hurt states that produce fossil fuels.
That's bat crap crazy. I hadn't heard about that. That's absolutely nuts. That's you're going to enjoin the government from doing research?
Yes, that is literally what this court did. Now, thankfully, the Fifth Circuit actually stepped in and reversed that judge because it was a rare, sane panel of the Fifth Circuit. It was not crazy Trump judges.
All right. Wait, I just want people to understand this. When you have a circuit court, there's what? Usually 11 justices on it?
More than that.
Okay.
To, you know,
oh,
15,
they sometimes
20.
They have like, right, 20. Okay. And it's, but when they hear a case like that, they'll have a panel of three judges who are picked out of a hat, more or less, or
more
are they
or
assigned?
Less.
And they make a decision. If you luck out, and on the Fifth Circuit, the vast majority of them are George W. Bush and Trump judges. But if you luck out and get like, you know, an Obama justice and a Clinton justice, and then, you know, maybe a George W. Bush justice or a Trump justice, you could get win that case 2-3. It could theoretically go en banc to the whole and get reversed there. But so what is happening with this EPA West Virginia case? It centers around the major questions doctrine, but that's just a made up doctrine that doesn't mean anything.
Right. So the major questions doctrine is Brett Kavanaugh's baby. He birthed it while on the D.C. circuit, and he is trying to make it a real thing on the Supreme Court. And it's this idea that when an agency regulates something that presents a major question of what? Of law, of the economy, of society, just a big question that you have to think really hard about, then courts should probably strike it down unless Congress authorized it in bold and italics and all caps within the last 6 months. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but that's basically the gist here, that unless Congress has said in terms explicit enough to satisfy Brett Kavanaugh that some kind of regulation is kosher, then the Supreme Court and the lower court should strike it down, which completely reverses the normal way that these cases are processed, which is that you assume an agency has expertise enough and is, you know, following the law enough to actually apply Congress's wishes unless you see evidence to the contrary. So it is a recipe for a transfer of power from the executive branch, from all of these federal agencies that are answerable to the president, to unelected federal judges who have no constituents and no elections and whom we can never vote out of office.
And I would also add, I mean, as you touched on, there's no metric in which to even assess whether what they did was even consistent with their own rules, because major question is exactly as vague as it sounds. We don't know if it crosses the threshold, if it involves a third of the economy, a quarter of the economy, 5% of the economy, 2% of the economy, you know, or if it deals with a number of people, or if it deals with like life and death, or maybe just injury or not injury, or just like it could literally be anything at that point. And just to remind people, this is sort of like a part of the whole non-delegation idea where Congress doesn't know what poisons are in the air. They're not scientists. They in charge the EPA to say what poisons are in the air. And how do you determine poison is by looking at studies and saying, if I have too much of this, I die. If I don't, you know, if I have however many microns per whatever it is, I die. And if not, then I live. That's what constitutes poison in the air. These are all questions that Congress could never, ever like establish on their own, because they're not out there taking air samples every day and then running tests on whether or not this is healthy for people.
Right. I mean, Congress does not know exactly how many molecules of mercury are safe to be in the drinking water. And similarly, when Congress passed the Clean Air Act and a bunch of amendments to the Clean Air Act, they didn't know which emissions exactly were going to harm human health and welfare. So they said, look, EPA, figure out which emissions are harming humans and the earth and come up with a way to limit them. That's what the Clean Air Act says. That's what the EPA would like to do with carbon. But it seems probable that the Supreme Court's conservatives will step in and say, well, Congress didn't use the word carbon, and so you are not allowed to regulate it until Congress specifically comes in and gives you metrics, which of course Congress is not going to do for a very long time, if ever. So this whole idea, non-delegation, major questions, it's just a backdoor way for the Supreme Court to exploit congressional gridlock and ensure that we do not have the many regulations that are necessary to keep our government running and to keep our society healthy.
If Kavanaugh invented this at the DC circuit level, there's nothing inhibiting any of the subsidiary courts to make their own decisions as to what constitutes a major question.
That's right. And they can also make up new doctrines if those don't fit the bill and just float them and see what works and what doesn't. They're throwing it all against the wall. Some of it's going to stick at this court.
And this is the, you know, like I'm old enough to remember, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago when it was all with decades of activist judges this, activist judges that. And to be clear, activist judges, to the extent that that even exists as a concept, really can only be measured how much authority are you taking from elected officials, essentially.
Yes. And the answer is a whole hell of a lot at this Supreme Court. And at least 5 of the 6 aren't even bashful about it. I think they enjoy taking this power and kind of reveling in it. And they don't even pretend to show judicial restraint or modesty. They think we're the kings. We got these jobs fair and square. And we're the ones who run the country now.
And just a quick point, the process by which they were nominated also emboldens them, because there is an understanding by the Republican Party that this is their last stand. This is the Supreme Court is going to be a way to stave off progress in every which way. And so that kind of emboldens them to be activists and not apologize for it. Plus, like the whole lifetime appointment thing.
Yeah, which no other country does. Every other country thinks we're crazy for giving mortal human beings a lifetime of absolute power. But that's a conversation for another day.
Right.
I know we're a little pressed for time, but let's New York State Rifle and Pistol Association. This is going to be the one where we're going to be walking to the subway and there's going to be dudes just walking around with their rifles, just to normalize it, essentially.
Yeah, and this goes to the earlier point about, you know, the justices aren't elected. We have many elected officials, and they have split on concealed carry. Most of the states allow concealed carry if you have a gun permit, but a number of them, including New York and California, do not. Congress has tried over and over again to pass a nationwide right to concealed carry, but Republicans couldn't get it over the finish line. So what do? They go to the Supreme Court, and they say, hey, because we can't pass this bill, how about you just basically enact legislation, call it a ruling under the Second Amendment, that everyone in every state has a right to carry a concealed weapon in public? And that's what the court is going to do in New York, strike down New York's ban, in the process, strike down California's ban, a number of other states. These bans are linked to lower gun violence, so this decision will have a cost in human lives, but the court doesn't care because we can't vote them out, so they don't face the consequences of their own rulings.
And lastly, Kennedy versus, is it Brenton?
Bremerton.
This is the one from, is it in Seattle? Or,
yes.
Or
outside of Seattle.
A coach was, made a practice of, after a football game, to go into the center of the field and begin to pray. And some kids started joining him. And then it became a thing. And then you started to feel ostracized if you weren't involving yourself in this prayer with the coach for the football team. And so he's basically told not to do it anymore, and he kept doing it.
And now he's arguing that he has a First Amendment right to engage in coercive Christian prayer during and in the course of his job duties on a public school campus. And the court's going to agree with him. And, you know, as obnoxious as the facts of this case are, because he and his lawyers really just lied to the court about what was going on. They pretended that it was silent, that it wasn't coercive. But the bigger threat is that the court's going to use the First Amendment to bring religious prayer back into public schools after outlawing it for 60 years. The court's going to say, well, it's actually teachers' right to engage in Christian prayer at public schools. So we cannot prohibit it because the free speech clause guarantees it, essentially overruling decades of case law that says you're not allowed to pray in public schools because that ostracizes kids who don't agree and alienates non-believers. So it's another one of these backdoor cases where rather than overtly overturning a precedent, the court just creates a new set of rights that people can use to erode an old case that we had thought was settled law.
I mean, honestly, it makes me want to quit this job, go be a baseball coach, convert to Islam, force all the kids to say Muslim prayers just so we can bring this case and see how it goes in that instance.
You might be able to do it with Judaism even.
Well, yes, that's probably true too.
You could skip the conversion process.
I don't know. I want to see what happens when we get outside of the Christian Judeo civilization game and see if the judges would feel as sympathetic to religions that they did not subscribe to.
I will say we should not make the mistake of ever expecting principled consistency from this court. While I welcome a Muslim coach trying to exploit this decision to say Allahu Akbar on a football field, I am certain that if that happened, the six conservative justices would find a way to differentiate that case and say he doesn't have rights.
I really do hope that there is an organization out there who is looking for a plaintiff to go and test this, because I think, like, you know, we're now moving into an era where the project, I think, for even the legal institution from the center to the left needs to be bringing cases to show the average American just how corrupted and political the Supreme Court, I would argue, maybe has always been on some level, but particularly now.
Yeah, I mean, to borrow a football term, they are flooding the zone right now. And they are just taking up as many blockbuster cases as they can. Maybe they're worried that Clarence Thomas's heart is going to give him some more problems. So they're like, let's just get it all done. And that is what we're seeing right now.
Mark Joseph Stern, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it, as always. We'll put a link to a couple of pieces that you had at Slate. And, you know, maybe we'll be talking to you again after this barrage deluge of cases. But I think it's been set up really well. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. For better or for worse, I hope to talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks. I'm in.
Set up like a mitzvah tank at Mila's school fair or something like that.
Yeah.
That's how you're fearing.
I
don't know.
It is. That's the thing, is that I wish I was a better coach.
because I would. That's the part that I would feel bad about.
The jihadists, the Worcester jihadists.
I would no. The problem would just be, the problem would be just like I'm not actually. You know what? North Dakota Lama said the Church of Satan, unironically, is the best group to fight against this. In fact, yes, that is true, and they will do that. But wow. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member, you get the free half, free of commercials, and you also get access to the fun half of the program, and you allow this show to survive and thrive. We rely on our members. That's the way that we maintain our independence. It's the way that we reject ads. It's the way that we keep the lights on and the microphones on. All the electricity is associated with that. So join themajorityreport.com. Matt. Oh, and also I should say just coffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check it out. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, we have Daniel Bessner and Derek Davison of American Prestige nice. Joining us on Left Reckoning tomorrow night for a nice sort of all-around discussion about world affairs. Also, we're doing the post-game will be free on Twitch for everybody. So twitch.tv/Left Reckoning. We're doing our summer streams, so we're giving that away. But patreon.com/Left Reckoning if you want to get access to the Patreon shows on Sunday and support us in doing the free Twitch streams.
Whoa, summer streams. You got a whole program. It sounds like Tanglewood.
There's also merch coming.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yep. I'm pretty all excited. Right. I should be modeling it next week.
Instant
Whoa.
Cop.
Whoa.
Instant all right. cop.
All right, folks. I'm just seeing people going like, every time you have a Supreme Court guest on, I get really depressed. Corporate and right-wing powers found their almost perfectly designed glitch in the system to have minority rule over everything from the bedroom to the environmental protections. Really doesn't feel like the left or even the left to center liberals could do anything about it without a 40-year plan to undo it. And we got like 10 years left till climate change wreaks havoc on the world. Damn, this blows. Left is best. Thanks for getting me into Michael Brooks. Spirituality is helping me a lot recently. Darlene Rudin. yeah, you're welcome. I know. I mean, you know. To the extent that this show has been, you know, dedicated to a specific set of issues, it has been trying to get people to appreciate the importance of our court system on our politics. And it was, it seemed at the very least more constructive or hopeful to basically be saying like, hey, there's a train coming down the train tracks. There's a couple of levers that could be pulled so that it switches and we don't run into that. And the levers were not pulled. And here we are.
Do you remember when Scalia died?
Yeah.
Do I remember when Scalia died? Yes.
I've been chasing that feeling ever since.
I think about it. I cheersed my buddy Alex, who zombed me with Literary Hangover. He was just over, and the news dropped. And I remember that was one of the few spontaneous cheersings of alcohol that I remember engaging in when it happened. And it just felt like the future seemed very different for a brief period of time, and then it realized, like, we're going to do the whole Merrick Garland thing and, you know.
When I was approached by Phil Griffin, who was the MSNBC executive. I don't know what his job was. He was the head of it. To do, to run our show on Peacock. And they wanted a second hour as well. He said to me, you know, I mean, it became clear to me, like, he had never seen the show. Like, maybe he'd watched, like, 5 or 10 minutes of it. But he was like, you know, you just got to be. And I said, you know, and there was no editorial control. They had no editorial control of the show. I was not going to sign up for anything like that. And he said, but you're not going to, you know, you don't say, like, really, you know,
bad, you know, inappropriate things, or I can't remember the way he phrased it. I'm like, I'm not sure what you mean. And he said, he gave an example of Ed Schultz, who was on MSNBC at one point, the late Ed Schultz, had said something about wanting, you know, maybe a Supreme Court justice to die.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly what the controversy was. And I said, oh, well, I should tell you that when Scalia died, I was very open about celebrating it. Like, I mean, I you know, celebrating is the wrong word. I just said, it's good that he died.
It's baked into the system.
It's good that he's died because there was literally, you know, if you're going to measure, you know, the impact of someone's life, you have to say, like, you know, like I said, I feel bad for his kids or his family or whatnot. I'm sure he was loved by people, or I suspect he might have been. But the fact is that many lives were going to be made better by his absence on the Supreme Court. And I said, and I would say that again today. You know, I don't pray for any Supreme Court justice to die, because I don't believe it works that way. But I have hopes. I have hopes. And he's like, well, as long as you, you know, say it in a rational way. And I'm like, well, that's the way I say it. And
yeah.
He's like, oh, okay. I mean, it was. And look, I think there is a very strong argument. I'm willing to hear, you know, I'm willing to entertain the opposite argument that there will be a lot less human suffering and arguably a lot more, I mean, just a lot less human suffering if three specific justices on the court were to expire or resign.
Yeah.
I don't, like, I'm not saying, like, I don't wish death upon anybody, but I do wish an absence of their lives within the public realm.
Yes.
And however that happens, that could be, maybe they, you know, just have like a stroke and they can't participate in something, or they resign, or they, whatever it is. But there is, it is inarguable that if three of those conservative justices were to go away in some fashion,
retire, we want them to have a lovely vacation home.
Yeah, I was going to say about when the Clarence Thomas thing. We were like, it's fine. If he retires, if him and Junie retire to a, you know, seaside locale, no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want them to have a nice vacation home and to forever. Stay there for the rest
in
of their
perpetuity.
Lives.
Well, I also
no,
want
for you.
But I just want to qualify that too with, like, I'm not saying if there aren't charges that we can bring against them at one point that
yes.
we shouldn't do that
Dependent
either. But
on house arrest.
But in general, I would make the trade no charges. And just, go on vacation. And I just think that it is impossible to argue. And there may be people who find this sort of like, you know, offensive in some way.
It sounds like utilitarianism.
But it's true. But it is impossible to argue that there will not be less human suffering if those people are not on the court. That's just, I'm sorry. It is the case. Even if there's something was, you know, horrible to happen to them, and I am including the human suffering that I do not wish upon anyone that would be involved in losing someone that is a loved one in that instance. Just in terms of just sheer amount of human suffering, it's without question. Okay.
With
so,
that said, hopefully we'll talk a little bit less about human suffering in the fun half.
Oh, it's going to be so fun. And we will see you there, 646-257-3920. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start like.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6,543 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.